Before we start the show, I want to thank the thousands of you, the thousands who have read This Book Will Make You Dangerous. Many of you have told me that the book's unique way of exploring fear, confidence, and purpose has had a lasting impact, that it's much easier for you to get clarity and direction about what really matters and what you want to do in this lifetime. It's also amazing to hear that quite a few of you have read it multiple times and even bought copies for friends. So thank you again. Just in case you weren't aware, I created a free companion video course for the book. And in these videos, I walk you through the big takeaways and practices from each chapter. And I even cover some extra stuff that's not included in the book. Information on how to access the course is in newer versions of the book. And if you own an older version of the book and you don't know how to access the course, just hit me up via the contact form at triplanier.com and we'll get you all set up. And one last thing, if you're one of the thousands who have already read the book, please consider leaving an honest review on Amazon so that others can decide if it's right for them. Again, thank you so much for reading This Book Will Make You Dangerous. And now let's start the show.
You are listening to The New Man Beyond the Macho Jerk and the New Age Wimp. Your host is men's coach and group facilitator, Trip Lanier.
Are you one of those guys who confuses homosexuality with pedophilia? How are gay men similar to straight men? And what can you learn from a gay man about improving the sex in your monogamous relationship? This week, Associate Professor King Mott is on the show to discuss taking on the Roman Catholic Church and what to do about you married guys that are cruising for ass away from home. Welcome to The New Man. Today I've got King Mott. He's an associate professor of political science and gender studies at Seton Hall University. Welcome to the show, King.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So you had a run-in with the Roman Church and your employer a while back. Tell us a bit about it. What happened?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think, you know, just a little time frame. I'm talking probably 2 years ago. At the time, the two things were going on. My position at the university, I was in administration and a faculty person. I was an associate dean in the College of Arts and Sciences. It was the same time that the American Roman Catholic Church had begun to respond in a much belated fashion, and from my point of view, to the pedophilia instances within the Roman Church. And the way that they were choosing to respond, which is clearly calculated because you're talking about a corporate set of bishops who know all the issues. These are very smart people. Their way to respond to the pedophilia was to blur a commonly held prejudice, which is to associate pedophilia with gay men.
Okay, so they came out of the gate and they're like, hey, if you're a pedophile, gay men and pedophiles are kind of the same. That was what they were saying?
Yeah, exactly. Well, what they were doing is they were going to the college seminaries across America and interviewing every single one of the seminarians to find out if they were gay, which was they were claiming then therefore to be responsible in addressing the pedophilia question, which is absolutely and utterly ridiculous.
So in order to root out the pedophiles, they were going to find all the gay men and kind of dump it on them? Is that what was happening?
Exactly, which is a hysterical considering the Roman Catholic Church, where easily a third of the bishops and priests are gay, if not more. There's plenty of social science research out there on that issue. It's really ridiculous. But what they were doing is they were playing into a stereotype, and they were equating two concepts and tacitly supporting bigotry. Because, of course, now you can say gay men not only are, you know, feminized, whatever it might be, but they're also subject to pedophilia, which is ridiculous. You, I'm sure you're familiar with this. Pedophilia, generally speaking, is someone that's close to these children, and it's an act of extraordinary pathology. Has nothing to do with sexual orientation. Never has been. There's a bit of research to pull that out. So I wrote a letter, New York Times. Saying that this is, to try and reveal this. I mean, this is ridiculous that an institutional church would make this kind of claim. long and short of it is the university operates under an administration that is largely Roman Catholic and certainly in relationship with the diocese here in Newark. And they removed me from my position. Thank goodness I had tenure and I fell back into the faculty.
Uh-huh. And so basically what happened is you're like, wait a second, you were the horn blower for this thing. I mean, were you the only guy in the room? Like, can you believe this shit? They're associating pedophilia with homosexuality?
It is comical from a distance. But no, I mean, and may get into something we talk about later. I don't think that is an unusual assumption given the prejudice that's often placed on gay people, gay men, LGBT community in general, and coming from a church which has a questionable approach to human sexuality to begin with, much less, you know, gay and lesbian people. I mean, the Roman Church and a lot of churches are erotophobic as much as they are homophobic. So it's not surprising, but it's quite difficult to accept.
And so Seton Hall, who basically has to report to the Roman Catholic Church, they had to like shut you up essentially, or they couldn't fire you, but they basically kind of threw you away.
Had to take me out of an administrative position, and Seton Hall is a fine university. The faculty came down against the administrators who were from my point of view almost compelled to do this and voted no confidence on the dean. So there was the university faculty responded like faculty wherever, good faculty, and recognized these things. These are opinions. They're not necessarily truths, and we should be able to talk about whatever we want to talk about.
Did you have any reservations before you took action, before you sat down and pressed send on that letter that you sent to the New York Times?
Absolutely not. I didn't even think about it. I mean, I work at a university. I'm a faculty person, and if anything, we're good at it. It's talking about controversial ideas, because that's the only way we come to any kind of, as humans, we come to some sort of consensus on these things. I never for a moment considered it would be problematic. After all, all of the research on men and women who are pedophiles is confirming on my point of view.
Yeah, and so here we are in the 21st century, and we've got one of the major institutions of the world trying to blur the lines here, and I imagine it still sticks with millions and millions of people out there.
Oh, it works. Of course it works, and that was what's more insidious about it. I mean, you have to know that educated people sitting in the, in these positions, they know how to play this. This is spin politics.
Mm.
The fact that the Roman hierarchy had been aiding and abetting pedophiles who were Roman priests hiding out and were moving them from parish to parish, that's a very damning fact.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Well, let's find a scapegoat. Must be the gay men.
Right.
And let's be frank, the whole gay man, and since this is what we're talking about in this instance, that's an easy target in American culture.
Yeah. Minorities across the board are coming up and sharing the table more and more with the typical white, straight American male establishment. And I'm wondering what it is that, from your position as a gay man, like what is it that this white male establishment is misperceiving about gay men and gay culture? What's going on?
Well, I think the good news is what's going on is that these ideas are changing. If you look at young people, particularly people under 35, even 40, they're understanding tolerance and awareness about LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer folk, very different than those people older. And in most instances, it's the older people who hold positions of authority, political, religious, social power. So I think that's the first thing, that there is a changing dynamic. Why is it easy? I think the shortest answer to that is homophobia is another form of misogyny. The fear of the feminine.
Hmm.
And we live in a society and a culture that it's no one's fault. White, straight men are not to blame for this. But we all are reared in a society that is patriarchal, where God is, generally speaking, a man. And, if you look at the CEOs of this country, the New York Times just published the top 200. Well, there are five women. Mm. And they were, Sarah Lee Cakes and Avon. So, you know, you're living in a patriarchal, male-centric society. Anything that challenges that is going to be, it's going to cause a lot of fear.
Yeah, I think so. And what I get about it is when we actually get to have personal contact and we actually get to know a person, and they're no longer a gay man or a black man or a lesbian or whatever. They just are Dave, Susie, and, you know, Peter or whoever. Suddenly the it's like, oh, wow, the fear kind of goes away. We see them as a human being again, and sexual preference or skin color doesn't matter as much. How does culture play into that? Because there are differences here. There are some significant differences in lifestyle here. How does that play in?
Well, you know, the irony of American culture when it comes to sex is that we are probably the most, we have more sex around us in terms of marketing, you know, music, etc. And yet we are probably, it's certainly in the developed nations, the most repressed in many ways sexual people. I mean, it's part of our culture is, I guess, you know, our Puritan inheritance. We are historically a very churched group. Many Americans identify with religious organizations. So there's this contradiction out there of, you know, everywhere you look, there's a naked body, but somehow something's wrong with it. I think there are a lot of mixed messages. And so where are we permitted to be free and sexual? Well, right now, if you ask most people, they'll say you can have as much sex as you want as long as you're married.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not where people are having sex.
Right.
You know, but that's the approved cultural, you know, safe zone.
There's a disconnect between what's really happening in our behaviors and then how we actually perceive the world. And it's just time to wake up to that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I more than wake up to it. I think we have to remind our leadership that, you know, at least from the American tradition, you know, this stuff is private. And fundamentally, unless I am somehow harming another person or a minor or some things that are certainly appropriate legal boundaries, you know, legislating sexual morality has never worked. It's not working now. And again, all it does is somehow communicate to, well, look at young boys. All of us had to survive a locker room, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the worst thing in a locker room? It's to be a fag.
Mm.
You know, you can be just about anything, slow, fat, tall, hairy, skinny, but be a fag. And you, even if you're not.
Right.
Just the name itself, maybe someone is, you know, I mean, this is stereotyping, but let's just say they're an intellectual.
Uh-huh.
They're not into sports. They're a fag.
They're different from the norm.
They're different from the power structure of what is the ideal masculine. And that's a very different sort of thing. And they cause these boys in the locker room fear.
Mm. The younger generations that are coming through are more tolerant. Is it because the conversation is more open?
Well, I mean, again, I have to look at media. I mean, Will and Grace and Ellen and music. I mean, there are just ways that it's been shown to be not something that is abnormal or psychotic, but just a fact of reality. I mean, most young people now know some gay people, probably in their extended family.
Yeah.
You know, you know somebody who's somebody, and it's not necessarily a shame-based reality. So I think you hit on that earlier. I think that once you're kind of out there and you see somebody, you know somebody, you know, things change. But let's not lose sight of the fact that most gay people are not safe in many areas of this country.
And you're talking physically safe, like they could be attacked, the hate crime?
Safe, emotionally safe. They are not safe.
Hmm.
You know, a straight man walks into an airport with whoever he's dating or married to, and he doesn't even think about how he's going to tell her goodbye. Gay couples that walk into airports have to decide. They make a political decision. Are we a couple? How do we demonstrate it or not?
Wow.
So every moment, the gay reality, even in urban societies, you know, one has to be on guard for where there might be harm. And that's the result of institutions like we began this conversation, important institutions playing into that bigotry.
So those are some of the ways I feel like we're just kind of tipping, you know, on the tip of the iceberg about how living a gay life is much different than living a straight life. But how are we the same? I mean, you've done a lot of men's work. You're involved with certain organizations in that. You've done a lot of work there. How are we the same? How are we similar?
We are similar. I'll refer you. There's an early gay leader by the name of Harry Hay who presented this idea, and I think it's a nice way to start on this conversation. He said that, and I'm paraphrasing, not directly quoting, but he said that, you know, people think that gay people and straight people, gay men and straight men, are the same everywhere except for what they do in bed. The truth is, we are the same in what we do in bed. We're different in every other way.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so what that means is, now whether this is because of the world we live in or because of some, it's called in the literature essentialism, you know, we're born a certain way, the fact of the matter is gay people see the world differently. If you look at gay ghettos, whether you're talking about Chelsea in New York or you're talking about the Castro in San Francisco, and they're believing, you know, how they're even in smaller cities all around, right?
Right.
If you look at peaceability in terms of any measure, assault, anything, that those crime rates are very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
They're non-existent. Gay people are different. They're not as, here we are stereotyping, which is what we don't want.
But yeah.
We're stereotyping for the sake of the conversation. We're not so driven. I mean, these straight alpha males are all over the place, you know, trying to kick a little ass, and you know, there's just as strong and just as intelligent and just as ambitious gay people, but we're just not into those things.
Hmm.
I don't mean to say that gay people are born to be a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
There's some support for that. But just about in every area, we see things differently. That's why we get along with women very well.
Mm-hmm.
Not because we are all alike, but because women are on the outside of that power dynamic too, and they also see, you know, the corporation or even the country club very differently than straight white men.
There's a shared value there. What was your attraction to men's work then? Well, help me understand. How did you get involved in men's work?
Well, I had a very, very good friend who said, you know, go do this. I'm involved in a project called the Mankind Project, which is an extraordinary experience for all kinds of men. I had a friend who said, trust me, don't ask too many questions and go. If I'd asked a lot of questions, I probably wouldn't have gone. And so I think the most important thing for me is that I have been able to have this kind of conversation.
Hmm.
You know, to be around straight men safely where the straight men don't, they can express their own homophobia, their own fears about this sort of thing. And quite frankly, you know, a lot of straight men have had same-sex experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And decided that, you know, it's not really for them. And there's a lot of shame around a lot of that stuff.
Right.
You know, so I think it's the opportunity. Men's work to me is about being a man, being in one's power, being in a place where truth is what I and the other men are seeking in a safe way.
Absolutely. What was your experience like going through these programs? Did you feel even more ostracized because you were gay and a lot of the other men were not?
Sure, sometimes I did. Sometimes initially in the work, I've been involved in men's work now for about 15 years. Early on, you know, I stayed in the closet. I worked on other issues. I worked on father issues or issues related to, you know, different things. And really kind of waited to see. That's something that gay men will do a lot. You know, we go into an environment and we know how to be a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
Know how to negotiate those things because we have to. Our survival depends upon it.
Right.
So yes, early on I did lie.
Mm.
Now, when you're new into that kind of experience, withholding, you know, that's what I'm calling lying.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that unusual.
You know, I can appreciate what you talked about of just kind of hanging back and being in a veiled place, because that's been my experience too. I related that, like, well, what is this? You know, it's kind of, it's easy to place when I go into these men's work things, it's kind of easy to just assume a very young position of being an outsider. Like, until I'm accepted, I'm not going to really reveal myself until it's really safe.
Absolutely. Well, there is, you know, trust is built and trust is proven and earned. But I do think that gay men and straight men have a lot to teach each other. Look at straight men and monogamy.
Okay.
One of the things that has been revealed in the study, social science study about gay relationships, is that monogamy is important to gay men, and I'm generalizing here.
Mm-hmm.
But what gay men value more is emotional monogamy. Not necessarily or exclusively sexual monogamy.
Right. So it's the felt sense that, yes, he may be exploring other men, but emotionally we've got a strong tie here, and I know he's not going to go away emotionally.
Right. And so I don't think that that's so different from straight men in a lot of ways. I mean, all you got to do is go to an airport bar, and you see a lot of straight men who are married who are clearly out cruising.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that they are disassociating from their families or their wives. They're out of town and they're horny.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, gay men have a lot to teach straight men about honesty in this regard. I can't tell you many straight men that I've ever talked to who don't struggle with monogamy.
Absolutely. It's a huge issue. I mean, the statistics are, you know, mind boggling. And
absolutely.
Yeah, there's a part of me, it's like, man, that sounds like a whole other show. What can we learn from the gay community about monogamy, about how to navigate this terrain of having sexual feelings for other people, still staying emotionally connected to our partner? That's huge.
Right, right. And believe me, it's not so easy. I'm not saying that we've got it mastered. But there is a lot of literature out there to support this notion that we have somehow begun to understand that we don't have to expect everything out of one person. That you know, our partner may be our partner. We may have absolute love and faith, and in many instances have family with these men, and women have families, gay couples. But and again, I'm talking mostly about men here, not lesbians.
Sure.
But we don't necessarily set each other up to be our everything.
You know, in the straight culture, there's the Prince Charming and the princess up in the castle. And once we find this person, once we find the one, we're basically set. There's not a lot of the fairy tale about what happens after that when you got to do chores and clean up after the kid and all that kind of stuff.
No, the story goes pretty cold after that. But I think there are a lot of frustrated marriages that have become emotionally and sexually dead. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they have fallen into an institution that doesn't support continued change, growth, and development. Here's something to consider for straight men, for example. Beyond even going out and saying, I want to have sex with this other woman, how about having the conversation with their wife that that's where they are?
Just saying, that they're even considering that emotionally or whatever, that they're even feeling these feelings?
That's right. I mean, because that opens up, you know, why? Why are we at this place now where you're thinking this? And you know what? The truth may be, she may be wanting this too.
Right.
Because, you know, he's coming home, rolling over and snoring in the night. I mean, you know, it's after 15 years together, you know, it doesn't necessarily look so pretty.
Yeah. I'm just taking away from this conversation the benefit of just being open and being open in a conversation, being willing to be with what is.
Yes. Yes. And again, I don't mean to claim that the gay community has, you know, has locked this down, but we are so much further along than the straight community that politically seems to want to, you know, claim this notion of monogamy and marriage. Well, if you look at marriage, it's not working that well in terms of divorce rates. And then those that stay married, and you know, how are they satisfied?
Right.
And so you asked earlier on, you know, what can we, you know, where are we, what do we have in common? I think that, you know, men are men. When it comes to sex, men, you know, they feel the same things.
Yeah. Well, I can appreciate that. If someone's listening to this show and they want to learn more and they want to dive into this conversation more, you mentioned that there's a couple of resources out there. Where could they dive in?
There's also a lot of information. I mean, you know, you're at our fingertips now in gender studies, on monogamy. All you'd have to do is a Google search, you know, in social science indexes. And it's not so sophisticated that it, you know, it's unaccessible. There's also a very good resource called CLAGS, the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies, that operates out of the City University of New York, which has a great deal of information. All that's readily available. Any of the group that organized to be the political side of the gay movement also have this information, Human Rights Campaign and many of the other local organizations.
Beautiful. King Mott, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and be on the show. I admire the work that you've done, and just admire you as a man. Thank you.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
Be sure to visit the New Man Podcast on Facebook and let us know what you got from this episode. Thanks for listening.